So I believe we are recording now. I hope we are recording now.
Is that number advancing?
Well, it's counting down from minus 68 hours, 17 minutes, 23 seconds, 22 seconds. So I'm hoping that that's a good sign.
Are there bars moving?
Oh, I should look at that, yes. And the bars are moving. Oh, right. Fantastic. We are cooking with gas here. So it's my great pleasure to welcome for the first time to Many Rivers Books and Tea, Eric Davis, the author of this book, Nomad Codes, that Eric will be talking about tonight, but also other books, Technosis, a fantastic title, and I guess probably your best-selling book, I'm assuming,
yeah.
Is translated into five languages. Also, The Visionary State and Led Zeppelin.
Four.
Now, I've seen it in two different forms. Led Zeppelin 4 and Led Zeppelin 33 and a third. Can
oh,
you
really?
Tell me which? Yeah, I
well,
saw that someplace.
The 33 and a third series is a series of books about individual records.
Got it. Okay.
And so it's about Led Zeppelin 4.
Got it. Okay. So, Eric grew up in Southern California. I found out about that by reading some of the material in Nomad Codes, and he is a writer who has written for Slate, for Salon, I believe, for The Village Voice, many venues, has lots of great material on his website, technosis.com, as I can testify myself, and we are really happy to have him here tonight, so
great.
Thank you so
well,
much
thank
for coming.
You. Thank you so much. Yeah, it's fun to be here. I love Sebastopol. I didn't realize how extensive and marvelous the tea selection here is, and I'm a tea fan, so it feels good. Like there's an extra good vibe, as well. We were just talking about how the metaphysical bookshop is a increasingly rare breed these days, which is a sad thing because I sort of cut my own spiritual teeth on metaphysical bookstores. You know, growing up in Southern California, I kind of grew up in the shadow of the spiritual counterculture. So going to the local used bookstore was a cornucopia of weirdness and marvels that so a lot of my first exposure to these matters was through books and through cheap used copies that were $1 or $2 that, you know, some, you know, bedraggled hippie had unloaded at some point. And so I really love the feeling of bookstores when they have this kind of focus. I'm really happy to be here. I think the best way to talk about Nomad Codes in to put in context is to talk a little bit about my career. And I'll keep it kind of brief because this book is a collection of essays that I put together a couple of years ago and some friends published on their independent press. And I was always sort of interested in spiritual topics. I went to a fancy pants Ivy League university and studied romantic poetry and religion, and was totally uninterested in going to graduate school. Partly because during my time there, I started to write for a student-run newspaper that was obsessed about popular culture and particularly about music and rock music. And the era when I was a student in the 1980s. Was the rise in scholarship of what's now called cultural studies. And basically cultural studies was just the idea that the cultural things that we are surrounded with in our everyday, including popular culture, dance music and comic books and, you know, all the sort of, almost the kind of riffraff of our cultural lives were really valuable things to look at, that as a scholar you shouldn't just be reading Shakespeare and Moby Dick, but you should also be looking at, you know, Tarzan and Madonna, and that these things were worth paying attention to. And this was tremendously liberating for me because I love this kind of stuff. And I started to write about it as an undergraduate. And when I graduated, I was like, I want to keep doing this. So I went to New York City and became mostly a music journalist, but writing about popular culture, mostly for the Village Voice. But taking it really seriously, taking these kind of silly things really seriously, and particularly in terms of their spiritual, occult, uncanny, and sort of philosophical power. Those were the things that really attracted me and really interested me. So a lot of other people were maybe writing about different aspects of these things, but I was always really tuned into that kind of uncanny space. And so a lot of the writing in the book comes out of this way of writing about culture, where I'm kind of paying attention to this sort of metaphysical, mystical, occult overlay, whether it's in heavy metal records or in television shows. And, you know, I wrote about the X-Files as soon as it came out because I could see that this was going to be hot. And, you know, so I had a kind of feel for this sort of vibration running through popular culture. And why I think that's kind of important is because I think one of the big stories to say about the modern world, you know, the last couple of centuries in Euro-American civilization, is that in many ways, many people describe it as a kind of process of disenchantment, where we increasingly see the world as a kind of banal, merely physical world of processes that we can understand with science, and that technology gives us the ability to control, and that the world of spirits, the world of Dharma, the world of the mysteries, is kind of increasingly seen as a sort of fiction, a kind of quaint poetry from the past, and leaving us in this sort of desolate kind of experience. And that's one way of telling the story of the modern world that has some truth to it. And if that is true, then And we also believe that people have a kind of inherent attraction, draw, and almost a nostalgia for spiritual experience, for religious mythology, for metaphysical possibility. Well, then where are they going to find it? Where are they going to make it happen? And, of course, one way they make it happen is this stuff, is all the ways that modern people have wrestled with other people's faiths, their own esoteric faith buried beneath the veneer of conventional Christianity and conventional Judaism, rediscovery of ancient ways, the fabrication of new religious paths, like the emergence of neo-paganism in the middle, in the middle of the 20th century. People say, yeah, we can do this again, and start making it up, but making it up in a really serious way. And popular culture is also part of that experience. It's one of the ways that people find out about this material, expose themselves to it, get fascinated to it, get introduced to it. So, in many ways, I was brought. One of the reasons I wrote about Led Zeppelin IV, and I knew when they said, "Hey, you should write one of these 33 and a 3 books about a record, any record you want," and I'm a music collector, I love thousands of albums. Why did I choose that one? Because for me, it was kind of a gateway drug into the mysteries. As a 13-year-old listening obsessively to this record, trying to decode it, trying to understand there's something here, there's some mystery here. And at the time, some Christians worried that there were satanic messages in the record, and that there was some kind of occult power, and that they were, the rumor was they were devil worshippers. But those were all kind of myths that people were telling about something that was actually kind of powerful, even though it was also a sort of cheesy object of mass consumerism at the same time. And that mixture of the mysteries right up against our kind of mass culture really fascinated me. And so a lot of what led to the kinds of writing in this book has to do with that kind of cultural criticism. So I think I'll just read a short section of a piece that came out of those kinds of interests in mind, and there are a lot of other things that I did that I'll talk about in a moment. And this was a profile that I wrote in the mid 2000s of a very obscure and very prolific kind of post-punk psychedelic crazy band called the Sun City Girls, who were sort of unnerving people, and not many people got to interview them, and they liked what I did, and so they kind of opened their doors, and it was a rather special experience. So this is just the beginning of the piece. That I think you'll get a little sense about how I approach popular culture through this. Alan and Rick Bishop are two half-breed desert rats on the cusp of middle age who live in Seattle and make music, when they do, in a trio called Sun City Girls. Rick's on guitar, Alan plays bass and sings, but the brothers play with lots of other things as well. Double reed pipes, gamelan, puppets, language, demons, audience expectations, states of consciousness. The third girl is named Charlie Gosher, and he's a scraggy Californian transplant the Bishop boys first met in the open mic scene in Phoenix over 20 years ago. Gosher plays drums, open, slippery, consternating drums, and he writes and occasionally lets loose some mighty ornery post-beat rants. The Bishop brothers are addicted to third world travel and have been so since they first hit the Moroccan hinterlands in 1984. Gosher joined a Bishop expedition only once during a 1989 trip through Indonesia. One night in Yogyakarta, a seaside city on the coast of Java, the trio stumbled into an itinerant Kuda Kepang group, a family troupe that entertained the crowds with a ferocious, gamelan-fueled mixture of magic tricks, hobby horse theater, and glass-eating, fire-breathing performance trance. Whenever tourists stopped, the leader cracked a bullwhip next to their heads and scared them off. The girls, characteristically, held their ground. Years before, when they first hit the stage with their peculiar mix of sardonic rock, outsider improvisation, and hippie mysteriosa, they could only get gigs at punk shows, and the crowds responded to their baffling sets and bizarre costumes with anger and violence. The band came to aggressively taunt these people, dishing out verbal abuse, sarcastic musical moves, and the occasional cup of urine. Guys like this can certainly deal with the stingless lash from a Javanese heavy. They could even see where the dude was coming from. So every night, the three young men would wait for what they called the call of the wild, the distant madcap clang, 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 that would lead them through the crowded city to the Kuda Kepang crew. After 2 weeks of this, they'd almost become part of the family, with Charlie banging out percussion as Alan fed light bulbs to the kids, their mouths a repulsive mass of lacerations and kerosene burns. You could even say a kind of transmission occurred. Alan describes it simply as the best show ever. A month and a half later, the girls were on a boat heading through the Strait of Malacca on the way to the Sumatran city of Medan. With nothing better to do, the trio asked the boat's lounge act to hand over their electric instruments for a set. The band ripped through what one might call a typical Sun City Girls set, House of the Rising Sun, Esta, Susan, and Casa from Horsecock Pfeffner, and a sun-baked skronk jam peppered with abrupt stops and starts. The Indonesian audience clapped at the beginning of every song and then clapped again at the end. Like nearly all girls' performances, this one was recorded, and Rick reports that at one point on the tape you can hear a patron lean over to his companion and proclaim, "Ah, this is American jazz." Purists might have trouble with this description, although Sun City Girls are more than capable of pounding out Duke Ellington and Paul Blade tunes. But if jazz means a deep commitment to improvisation, and if improvisation means having the guts to force the hands of chance, then the Sun City Girls most certainly are jazz. They are most certainly not purists. Sun City Girls traffic with bizarre miscegenations, self-indulgent trash, and hardcore mystic exotica. Their sometimes garish album covers attack the eye with devils, yonis, sacred transvestites, and nubile natives. Lyrics, song, and album titles like Naga Smoke Signals, The Genghis Necronomicon, and 333,000 Crossdressers from Beyond the Rig Veda can sound like the spontaneous verse of young poet Maudit tanked up on National Geographic cheesecake and a pictorial history of magic and the supernatural. This lurid romance with the other fuels some of their most incandescent sounds as well, a music of transport that explores Middle Eastern, Southeast Asian, and South American atmospheres with a passion composed equally of informed pleasure and the heedless appropriation of the strange. Looking high and low, far and wide, the Sun City Girls have sought the wellspring of the weird, of what H.P. Lovecraft called outsideness. And when they have found them, they have taken what they wanted. On that boat in Indonesia, they got to give some of it back. So that's a somewhat extreme example of the sorts of material that interested me. And I was very lucky in that I was sort of able to make a career out of this stuff for a few years back in the day when you could make money off of magazines more than we can today. And so in many ways, it's the internet just rendered my kind of job a very difficult thing to sustain. But in the early and mid-1990s, it was quite a wonderful time. It was also a time that I was really interested in the emergence of the very technology that would make my own career somewhat more challenging in the future. I was very into the internet before the World Wide Web. I was on in 1993, and I was in chat rooms and did early MUDs and Moos, and I went to virtual reality gatherings, and I was really fascinated because at that point, this technology that is now ubiquitous, transforming our lives, irritating, terrifying, unavoidable, that we all deal with every day, at least most of us every day, was then mostly on the horizon, you know, or the ways in which you want interacted with it were still very creative, very interesting, even a little underground, a little countercultural. So it was a very different moment, a really fascinating moment, and one that was full of expectations and dreams and possibilities. And people were imagining all sorts of remarkable ways in which this would change, improve, flower culture. So it was a really fascinating time to be interested in technology. And in many ways, my first book, Technosis, is about this process whereby new technologies enter into our lives and they become sites of imagining, of speculation, of fantasy, of hope, of our dreams, almost sometimes literally. There's almost an uncanny quality to a lot of modern electronic technologies that evoke these much older sorts of dreams and possibilities and fears as well. So that was a very interesting balance for me, and there's one of the pieces, there's a number of pieces about technology in the book, but one of them is called Meditating in Sensoround, and it was about a period of my life in 1995 when I was doing, just beginning my serious Zen practice, which lasted many years, and I was at a Zen retreat in near Idlewild in Southern California, and then immediately upon finishing this retreat, I went down to Los Angeles and met some friends at SIGGRAPH, and SIGGRAPH was a very important, at that point it was a very important kind of gathering of computer designers, so you'd see all this crazy futuristic computer-aided design and virtual reality and new games and all this kind of very wild, weird times in the sort of technological imagination. And so what I'm going to read now is from the tail end of from that piece, and it gives you a little sense also of how I, beyond this kind of obsession with certain kinds of popular culture that I was talking about, rock music, et cetera, became interested in finding different ways to talk about spirituality and the seeker culture, which in many ways I kind of consciously birthed myself in being a curious teenager and exploring this sort of Southern Californian landscape. So here we are at SIGGRAPH. SIGGRAPH was a savage temple of the electronic image, its booths and exhibits shrines for a cacophony of cults whose terminal screens offer magical gateways into the surreal and tacky landscapes of the digital unconscious. See the unbelievable, witness the unthinkable in 3D, the garish sign proclaimed. It was a stray-light virtual theater, so this is 1995, and featured a dozen blank-faced folks reclining on chairs that occasionally shook, each person outfitted with a bulky head-mounted display that projected a computer-animated 3D video onto their eyeballs. These folks looked like zombies in a liquid crystal opium den, though I had to remind myself that, after all, I had just spent a week staring at a wall. The video that so absorbed their attention was an intense hallucinogenic spin on one of the most potent and infectious mythologies of the modern West, the extraterrestrial encounter. The video's creator was Steve Spear, a brash and innovative computer animator who mixes scatological satire with archetypal splendor. His Carl Jung's dream brilliantly fuses images of cathedrals and Norse gods with golden feces and giant worm-like penises, which is appropriate to Carl Jung's vision, famous vision of the god pooping on the cathedral. In this piece, it's true, it's in the books. In this piece, a little kid gets sucked into an alternative dimension by a crew of diminutive almond-eyed gray aliens. Strapping on a head-mounted display, I found myself somewhat underwhelmed with the ride, mostly because the point of view kept switching between first and third person perspectives, jarring cuts that ruined the goal of psychic immersion. But when it came to the primal scene of UFO abduction lore, the piece became all too compelling. I, this little virtual I, lay on a surgical table in a flying saucer, and a group of impassive grays leaned over me with buzzing surgical drills in their spidery hands. I shivered as their tools descended towards me, even though I do not usually fear psychic surgery at the hands of cartoons. Perhaps what spooked me was the sense that this VR experience symbolized the secret dream of contemporary media to invade and rewrite consciousness itself. It drove home how insane technological culture has become. Unmoored from folkways, grasping after figments, addicted to the novelty and tyrannical demands of a hyperactive society, we drift in overdrive. Amidst all the distracting noise and fury, the hoary old questions of the human condition, who are we, why are we here, how do we face others, how do we face the grave, these sound distant and muffled, like fuzzy conundrums we've learned to set aside for more compulsive and profitable queries. Unless we open up clearings within the space-time of our lives, unless we take media fasts or dare to wander off the grid, such questions may never arise in all their implacable awe. And so we try to recover our attention and draw it back towards embodied experience, towards real earth and the mindful now. We hear a lot about ordinary enlightenment today, about embracing our own equivalent of chopping wood and carrying water. This desire for authenticity, for reality and the natural is also part of our popular culture, packaged and marketed in New Age catalogs and the shelves of beauty salons and health food chain stores. The fact is, we don't really live in a world of chopping wood and carrying water anymore. The processes that we call variously globalization, the information age, postmodernism, and the biotech revolution are now the backdrop of seeking, and they perhaps need to be drawn into the foreground. The fact that you can buy CDs of Siberian shamans or score a paperback copy of secret Dzogchen manuals by aiming your web browser at Amazon.com, remember this is 1995, is only a trivial symptom of a far more tumultuous transformation in the world spirit. Some fear that the relentless growth of global capitalism will dash whatever hopes we have of creating a sustainable future on the surface of this bleeding and tottering globe. Others fear that the New World Order will lead to insidious forms of media surveillance and social control. Sound familiar? And even if we dodge this multinational 1984, we still have to face Brave New World and its specter of rampant genetic engineering, happy pills, and an entertainment culture of soulless simulations. So how does one embrace spiritual practice in a world of digital capitalism, commodified DNA, psychopharmacology, and a steady stream of information about a planet falling apart at the seams? Though nostalgic and even reactionary sentiments have their place in a world intoxicated by novelty, I do not believe that a romantic retreat into old religious myths or Luddite primitivism is the answer. Though pockets of the gone world persist, there are no traditions that have not been marked by the peculiar dynamics of our time, not Tibetan Buddhism, not esoteric Christianity, not native ways. Slowly, tentatively, a network spirituality suggests itself from the midst of yearning and confusion, a multifaceted path that might humanely and intelligently navigate the technological house of mirrors without losing the resonance of ancient ways or the ability to slice through the venality and delusion that court human life. Against the specter of new and renewed fundamentalism, free-thinking seekers both inside and outside the world's religious traditions are trying to cut and paste a wealth of teachings, techniques, images, gods, and rites into a path grounded enough to walk upon. The mix-and-match spirituality derided by traditionalists is only the surface of a far more supple and dynamic synthesis in the making, one that demands a form of being we have only begun to intuit, open-ended and integral, embodied and green. This path is a matrix of paths, with no map provided at the onset and no collective goal beyond the tenacity and grace of our step. Such a network path opens up an ecumenical space far more radical than New Age fantasies of global unity or the bland interfaith chats between liberal monotheists. We log onto this emerging intranet when we accept that we will not transcend the sometimes agonizing tension between the world's various structures of belief and practice. Nor will we simply overcome more contemporary conflicts between faith and skepticism, the stones and the stories, the mundane absurdity of everyday life and the incandescence of the absolute. Instead, these tensions and conflicts become dynamic, calling us to face the other with an openness that does not seek to assimilate them to our point of view. By replacing the need for a common ground with an acceptance and even celebration of our common groundlessness, such network spirituality might creatively integrate these tensions while also learning when to let the gaps and ruptures alone. These are the spaces in which we simply breathe. So I wrote that 10 years ago. It's kind of interesting to hear it now and to hear like what parts I go, oh, really? Maybe. And some parts are like, ooh, that's sort of creepily just the same except worse now, you know.
What's the name of that essay?
That essay is called Meditating and Sense Around. And it was part of a collection. Let me see what if I can remember what the book was called. Called Radical Spirit.
Sense Around,
which was like a technology, a cinema technology in the 1970s, where they wanted to have like the music, you know, like so the disaster movies were always in Sense Around, like the Poseidon Adventure and you know all that kind of stuff.
IMAX.
What's that?
IMAX.
I think it was earlier than IMAX. It was like all the way.
Yeah, IMAX takes it to a big level.
Yeah, a whole of it. So like Cinerama, yeah. But it was particularly a sound technology like Dolby. So, you know, I can keep on going, but I saw, you know, if anybody wants to ask questions along the way, I'm totally happy to, like, turn this into a discussion. Excuse you?
How do you put the UN into all this?
The UN? Yeah. Do you mean, like, what's up with the UN in terms of the global? You know, what I try to do with that kind of stuff is, and I might even talk about it a little bit more with another reading that I'm going to do. In fact, let me just... I'm going to do another reading, and I'm going to address some of the issues that are raised as we try to figure out what's going on, and as we face a variety of conspiracies and also information about how things are put together, because I think it's a really important question. I don't have a particular opinion myself about how the UN functions and the global transformation and who's holding the cards. I'm more interested in how we tell stories about what we think is going on, because it's a very interesting thing, and it does have a lot of spiritual components to it as we try to figure out these very... That's true. I could talk about the Grateful Dead. I didn't write... There's one little part about the Grateful Dead in here. Maybe I'll just read it. It's just like a paragraph or two. Since you brought it up, we can bounce around hypertext here. This is from a piece called The Paisley Gate, which is about tantric psychedelia. I first visited Green Gulch Farms on a sunny Sunday in the fall of 1995. A group of students were sitting around the alien rows of eucalyptus trees, talking casually with Tenshin Reb Anderson, then abbot of the San Francisco Zen Center. Jerry Garcia had recently died, and at one point in the conversation, a blonde 40-something woman asked Anderson, in all seriousness, whether Garcia was a bodhisattva. Myself, I would have failed this particular Marin County koan, but not Anderson, who answered the question promptly and without condescension. He first described the Buddhist idea of protectors, beings who can be said to encircle and guard the Dharma without being entirely within the fold. Presumably, Anderson was taking inspiration from the Dharmapalas of Tibetan Buddhism, especially the Lokapalas, ferocious local spirits who swore allegiance to the Buddha way only after being magically subjugated by the tantric missionary and wizard Padmasambhava. Some of these shamanic entities are even said to not fully accept the Buddha's teaching. Though integrated within Tibetan Buddhism, they retain an intense liminality or in-betweenness. And as the recent Tibetan culture wars over the protector spirit Dorje Shugden make clear, one monk's manifestation of Manjushri can be another monk's bloodthirsty demon. In any case, Anderson's response was brilliant. Without castigating whatever visionary and communal ecstasy deadheads managed to extract from their loopy scene, Anderson established an open border between Garcia and the Dharma, at once separating the two while acknowledging their connection, a connection that, in the Bay Area anyway, is as local as a Lokapala. But though American Zen and the Grateful Dead have both served as major attractions in Northern California's spiritual carnival, the abbot also needed to draw the line. On the far side of the line lay drugs, because drugs, Anderson made clear, were definitely not the Buddha way. So I, you know, developed this, and what I do in this piece is talk about the role of that psychedelics have played and continue to play in American Buddhism. because it's a very interesting story that in many ways is kind of swept under the carpet. A lot of the early practitioners from the counterculture in the 1960s were refugees from the psychedelic experience. Some of them continued to use psychedelics in a spiritual way even at the time. And so their whole that whole early moment was swimming in a sea of psychedelic possibility, transformed into the desire to have clear mind and actual practices replace the need to constantly be taking something and all the negative aspects of drug culture. And then as a lot of these students and scenes became more established, as these young Turks became Roshis and Lamas, they tended to kind of put them on the carpet because it's a little controversial. They don't really want to talk about that. And so if you ask most American Buddhists who have any power what they think about drugs, they're going to tell you that drugs are not the way. Okay, that may be true, but they're certainly involved a lot more intimately with the experience of American Buddhism than most American Buddhists recognize. And so what I argue in this piece is that psychedelics for American Buddhists and for American spiritual practitioners in some more general sense is sort of the equivalent of Tantra. The Tantra in Asia, not the sexual Tantra, the California Tantra that we think of, but the classic Tantric traditions in Buddhism and Hinduism have within them a sort of left-handed, as they say, tendency to break rules, to break taboos, to do the things you're not supposed to do, because that's a source, A, of spiritual and magical power, and B, a recognition of the ultimate emptiness of all our moral orders and ways of organizing social reality. So you're not supposed to be eating the cow. We're going to eat some cow. In fact, might even eat a little human being sometimes. There are sexual practices. They take alcohol. That's a part of the tantric tradition, which is vast and complicated, but it's an important strain within it. And so basically I'm saying that the psychedelics in Buddhism, in American Buddhism, have a similar kind of function. They're like secrets people don't want to talk about, but they're actually enormously important, and they have their own particular lessons to teach. And I'll just suggest one lesson here that I think is actually a rather profound one. In Zen in particular, which is the tradition I know the best, there's a particularly strong emphasis on the emptiness of the kinds of magical phenomena that can happen to you when in the course of meditation. So whereas in some meditative practices, the idea that you're, you know, seeing a being of light would be like, wow, you're really doing it well. In Zen, they're like, that's just makkyo, what they say. It's just part of the, just leave it aside and keep on practicing. You know, don't get caught up in the visionary aspects of spiritual experience and meditation. It's about something deeper, which brings me to a little tangential story that you'll find amusing. So I'm like 5 days into a Zen retreat, deep state of calm, very calm, very little cognitive overlay. I'm in the moment. It's flowing. It's rich. It's beautiful. It's like, great, I'm delicious, I'm mellowed out, whew, relief. And I'm sitting there, and then like off in the distance I start hearing this kind of bell, sort of like the bell, you know, sort of like that bell you rung a little, and then like a gong, and I'm like, oh man, I'm hearing what they call heavenly music. Like this, like one of the phenomena that happens to deep states of meditation is you'll hear heavenly music, and they talk about it in the books, different traditions acknowledge it. So I'm sitting there going, wow, I'm hearing heavenly music, and I'm like, I'm just going to listen to it. And I was like, and then my inner rock critic came out and went, it's kind of cheesy. It's sort of new age. I was like, you know, it's okay. I can imagine better heavenly music. I thought that was kind of funny. So I was like, there's no escaping who you are. Anyway, so the point being that this is a problem that a lot of meditators fall into, is that they have some extraordinary experience, heavenly music, they see a being, the being tells them something, and that's truth. They've finally gotten it, that's reality, that's a new belief, that's part of the foundation of their belief system. It's a dangerous trap. It leads to psychic inflation. It can really be, it can be a real problem on the path. Well, psychedelics are very interesting that way, because psychedelics taken with great openness and verve and spiritual sensitivity can produce extraordinary experiences of cosmic, metaphysical, and religious import, but they stop when your body stops metabolizing the substance. So they teach you directly, without any overlay, that these remarkable experiences are things that happen in your body and that have physiological dimensions to them. Not saying they're just physiological, but they're part of the way your body processes things. And they come and they go. And if you hold on to them when they go, you're probably blowing it. I mean, you can make that mistake with psychedelics as well, and plenty of people do. But I think in an awake view of how those processes operate also involve the way they disappear and they go away, and then you're left the day after. Now what? Have you changed or not changed? Are you going to take something from that or not? Are you going to seek to repeat it? What are you going to do? And those questions, I think, are very useful questions for people in other kinds of spiritual practices to ask, but they tend not to do them because there's more of a sense of reality around the experiences that are produced in the practice, the meditation practice, the yoga practice, et cetera, et cetera. So that's kind of some of the stuff that I'm playing with in that. In terms of the Grateful Dead and how they relate to the internet, it's very interesting. Very, very interesting. You know, we think of the Grateful Dead as being this kind of hippie holdover, sort of, you know, psychedelic bacchanal back in the day. It's these images of, you know, it's real earthy, you know, people look like, you know, the fans look like farmers with their overalls and long hair and everything. But the Dead and the Dead scene played an extremely important role in the development of computer culture, because the Whole Earth Electronic Link, which was one of the first really important online bulletin boards that emerged in the 1980s, is long before the World Wide Web, when people are starting to use computers to communicate with one another and to develop communities and conversations that existed in this new kind of space, that one of the main drivers at the time were tapers who were trading Grateful Dead tapes. So it became an immediate site for this culture around the Grateful Dead that was really interested in information, in recordings, in keeping databases and logs. There's a kind of geekiness to aspects of the Grateful Dead culture that went right into the early computer stuff. And then, of course, John Perry Barlow's interesting career, the lyricist that for the Bob Weir songs, not as important as Robert Hunter is in terms of the band, but still a very important member of the Grateful Dead, who became a very strong proponent of internet freedoms and helped found the internet, Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is one of the leading organizations that help protect privacy in the in the era of big data and NSA surveillance. So the ties between the Grateful Dead and the internet and the digital culture are quite interesting and quite deep. Anything else?
Yeah, I was interested in the theme you sort of opened up earlier with the essay you'd written in 1995 about the kind of the contrast between the seeking in a sort of technologically rich world and the kind of the previous engagements or the previous opportunities for engagement with spiritual practice. And I'm curious how in the subsequent 10 or 12 years mm-hmm. since you wrote that essay, do you still mm-hmm. see that view, or has mm-hmm. that view modified to some extent?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I ask myself a lot. I'm not really sure exactly what the answer was, because at that point, it really was precisely because the technology had not really been as defined as well, and it wasn't quite so much in our face, that there was a space to imagine and to explore and to hope for the way that it would function in people's lives. So there was more opportunity, I think, at that point for people to integrate some of their more their experiences and their desires that are rooted in some of these traditions with this emerging space, how people were going to connect with one another, how information was going to be passed along, how teachings could appear. So there was a way of most religions were just beginning to start to use these tools. I wrote a piece for Wired magazine in like 95 or 96 that was about this Asian Classics Input Project, which basically involved monks, you know, Tibetan monks in India, sitting there in front of, you know, cheap PCs, inputting the Tengyar and the Kangyar texts, and then having that be available on DVD. And there was this lama who wrote this kind of beautiful traditional Tibetan style poem, sort of praising this new media. And he talked about the sort of rainbow lights of the data and all this kind of really amazing stuff. So there was a certain place where there was a kind of a sense of rapprochement. And here you have next week, you have this person who's talking about spiritual software and how software can you know, be part of it. So there are all these places where the two worlds link. But I think part of what I was interested in the 90s and that led to my book Technosis was really trying to like push them together as much as possible and see how they could relate and where the tension was. And now I just think it's a very different world. These things are so ubiquitous that everything is marked by them in a way that makes that particular connection maybe a little less clear. And I also am more pessimistic about the general effects that it has on society. Like it's sort of like I saw some dreams that were possible and a lot of those things didn't really come out that way. And there's still wonderful possibilities, but we're in, I think, kind of a rear guard situation vis-a-vis the large scale effects of digital communications on human culture, and I try to keep my optimistic side going. That's part of the good thing about being a journalist is you kind of have to be like, oh, we know there's possibilities here or whatever. But it is a very different world. And I think one of the main ways I would talk about it in terms of spiritual practice is the relationship to time, mm-hmm. And that with meditation, with yoga, with visionary explorations, with dream work, we're all sort of like finding the different quantum qualities that are available and changing our orientation towards time, away from clock time, you know, away from the steady pulse. And now the steady pulse is digital, and it's like these devices are in our lives, and they're more and more organizing, micromanaging our movements and our time, and everywhere we're sort of on the clock. The preciousness of being able to access a different kind of time, I think, is even more, more important. It's more of a call, which makes these practices, I think, even more of a sort of a survival necessity, almost more than a spiritual exploration. Like just the ability to have some degree of awareness or control over how you are organizing time right now in this moment is an incredible gift and a very useful skill or ability as we try to navigate through a world where clock time, digital clock time, is so excruciatingly omnipresent. So since we're talking about technology stuff, I'll read this the little bit that I was referring to earlier when you asked your question about the UN. This was one of the things that I like to do in my more sort of when I've been given kind of creative license is to write about my own experience, but to sort of use it as a way to feed into larger questions and philosophical questions, ways of looking at the culture. And it's a real fun way to live my life, where I'm like looking at my own experience, being open to my own experience, but not just as a record, not just as a memoir, but as something that might access some interesting issues or sort of hidden aspects of the culture. I mean, that's one of the things about being a culture critic with a spiritual interest that I am, is that in a way it's kind of like doing dream work, where like a dream you know that the surface level is not the really important level. It's when you start to unpack what the meaning of the lion in my dream. Why was the lion eating an ice cream cone? What was that about? It seemed really important at the time. And then maybe as I work with it, I realize that the lion is a symbol of something else, connects to something that happened to me or some other. There's a way of reading the dream that draws us more fully into its meaning. And in a way, culture functions like that. There's a surface level. And yeah, people are really in what a reality TV or whatever. They're into Survivor or something, you know, and it's like some stupid show and whatever, you know. I don't want to think about it. But then I start to think about it. I go, well, why is that model of competition so important to us right now? And then you start to unpack it, pull it apart, and sometimes you get a glimpse of much deeper things that are going on in the society and the sort of collective unconscious as it's mediated, as it expresses itself through these cultural things. So here's one little story. I think this, the date will be important because technology is always changing. 2001. A couple of months ago, after flying into Chicago on assignment, I rented a car. Since it was on someone else's dime, I got a Chevy Impala, a smooth ride with a cool bubble curves and a dashboard that glowed like the console of a shuttlecraft. Making my way from O'Hare to the Doubletree Inn in Skokie, I turned on the radio, stumbling across the city's peculiar progressive rock station, KXRT, like Dungeons and Dragons on your radio. Styx's Come Sail Away soon forced me to abandon ship. Then I tuned into a Christian station where I spent the next 20 minutes listening to one of the most awesome sermons I've ever heard. Between throaty bursts of songbird glossolalia worthy of Al Green, the preacher man filled the rent-a-car with a powerful blend of joy and dread. My God, I don't want to die. Indeed. The next evening, I was returning from Evanston to my hotel. For some reason, the car's interior light wouldn't shut off, and I fumbled for the proper button. Like many Americans, I challenged the interface designers of cars, not to mention software, by not bothering to figure out how anything works before I hit the road. I noticed a cluster of buttons lining the bottom of the rearview mirror. Accordingly, I aimlessly swatted them until the light blinked out. However, I also seemed to have triggered the car phone I didn't know I had, as the familiar drone of a dial tone came across the entertainment system. Not knowing how to turn off the phone, I simply turned the volume knob on the radio down, figuring that in the absence of a dialed number, the phone would simply shut off after the, "if you would like to make a call," lady had her say. I was feeling restless. Though the drive was short and I tried to avoid switching on the radio simply to manage nervous energy, I turned up the volume dial and discovered the radio was already on. I heard a droning male voice, which I assumed was another Christian preacher, although this guy sounded moralistic, boring, and white. Feeling displeased with myself for my inability to drive 15 minutes without any sonic distraction, I turned the volume knob down again, still unsure about how to shut off the radio itself. But after a few moments, my restlessness got the better of me, and I yanked the knob back up, enabling me to hear the following. "If you do not respond immediately, we will automatically dispatch a police vehicle to your location." A spine-trembling beat. Hesitantly, though without logically processing the action, I said, "Are you talking to me?" "Yes." What's going on? "Oh, this is the OnStar advisor. You have activated the emergency system. It's our policy to contact the emergency service if we don't hear a response. Is everything okay?" Yeah, I'm going to rent a car. I didn't know what I was doing. You freaked me out. Sorry." "That's okay. If you have any further questions, just press the blue OnStar button on your rearview mirror. Good night." The radio stayed off the rest of the way. So why I mentioned this when you asked your question about the UN and the sort of sense of like the secret forces and what's actually going on and what the NSA doing with our records and all the blah, 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 all this terrifying stuff, the way that we have to wrestle with conspiracy theory whether we want to or not. The reason I brought that, I read that piece, is because that's not really about an idea of what's happening, a concept, a story I have about what's really running the world or what's really going on with all this technology and surveillance. Instead, it was an experience on an emotional, psychological, and almost dreamlike level. Because one of the things that I think happens with technology is there's kind of an uncanniness around it sometimes. But those uncanny moments we have with technology, a weird synchronicity online, or somebody calls us just as something we're seeing happens, or you know, we pick up the phone just when somebody else says, "Hey, I'm just going to call you," and you know, there's this weird kind of uncanniness that happens in our relationship with technology sometimes, with media. And I think those moments are incredibly important to pay attention to and to feel your way through, because some of what's happening as we try to imagine, is it the UN, is it the NSA, are there, you know, aliens from you know, Orion who are running the, you know, British government, is the Queen an alien, you know, whatever. There's this whole world of you go from one conspiracy to another and you don't know where to stop and all the portals open up. And I can talk more about that. But before you get into the level of what the story is, what your concept is about what's happening, there's also a level of affect, of emotion, of a kind of sense of the surreal twisting of our ordinary reality that's really important to pay attention to as is. I mean, one of the ways of thinking about it is like reading, you know, hearing about the Snowden's revelations on the NSA. Now, anybody who pays attention, anyone who's paranoid like me, is not really surprised by any of this. However, there's something about the starkness of and the fact that it's been revealed on a large scale that gives it a different kind of character. There's a sort of solidity to it that it didn't have before. And what I noticed, though, is that immediately when I got up in the morning and turned on my computer and started doing my email, it felt a little different. Felt a little different. I'm like, oh, well, that's because I'm paranoid. I have an overactive imagination. And I'm like, okay, but it feels a little different. There's a little twist in the picture. And that sense of the kind of emotional level, the not conceptual, but sort of almost psychic level of our experience with technology, I think is really, really important to tune into, because it ends up having a strong influence on what we end up thinking and doing with these things. And it's, I think, really important to be aware of that dimension, because it can open up into really deep and interesting issues. Do you have a comment?
A question.
Sure.
And I'm wondering if you could, I'm fascinated by your response to the technosphere, you know, like entering the technosphere the way you enter a dream realm or enter a psychedelic experience. My question is that I wonder if that's a generational thing, because when I, you know, when I enter the technosphere, it's kind of like entering a nightmare at times.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, because it's like confusing,
mm-hmm.
and the instructions look very clear, but you know what's supposed to happen doesn't happen.
Yeah.
You know, something else happens.
Yeah.
And what I notice with younger people, the younger generation, when they enter the technosphere, it's a very different experience.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm perfectly willing to call, you know, an 18-year-old and say, I can't do this. Will you, you know, guide me through here? You know, like, so I'm wondering how that impacts your service.
Totally. Oh, no, I think that's true all the way. And I'm in a very interesting generation. The way I describe my generation, I was born in the summer of love, is that I'm the kind of this I live in the analog sunset. I'm kind of the last generation that grew up with analog media, saw the, you know, I remember I was 10 maybe 9 years old or 10 years old, and my friend Doug Kearney's older brother was a super nerd, and he had an Altair, and he was he's in this dark cave of a room, and he'd come out to watch Star Trek reruns, and then he would go back in, and one time he showed me how it worked, you know, and this is where the memory was a little cassette tape, and you know, old school. And that was like, and as soon as I saw one of those devices, I was fascinated by it. But I was fascinated about, like, the way that I was fascinated by, like, you know, wizardry and sword and sorcery novels. Like, it was something that was already kind of imaginal to me. And so I was always very aware of computer technology. Like, it always seemed kind of cool and weird and fascinating as this sort of thing. And so I was interested in these things from the get-go. But I also had all of those rich experiences of analog media. And then my young adulthood and my continuing adulthood is basically just the stripping away of all of that material and the translation into this digital order that the generation right below me is just, you know, it's just like liquid. It's just the air you breathe. There's no big deal. What's the problem? What are you talking about? I mean, you know, I taught a class to undergraduates a couple of years ago, and I was like, oh my God, these people there's always been the internet. They've always had an internet. They've always had a worldwide web, let alone an internet. I mean, there was always an internet in the background in my lifetime, almost. But in terms of like it being a cultural force, they have always had that. So I totally agree with that, which is partly why I'm not so sure how some of the spiritual things continue to play out for other people, particularly younger people. I'm not really sure how much I'm not just sort of narrating my own generation's experience of dealing with the baby boomer counterculture and looking forward to how things are going to be changing now in this new regime. And I'm okay with that. There was a certain point in my own life when I was like, oh my God, since I was into it and I was a technology journalist, I was like, what's the latest thing? What's happening? You know, okay, people are getting this. And then at some point I realized that I wasn't really like an early adopter. I was like, I'm kind of a late adopter. Actually, why would I even adopt at all? And then I had this vision, and it was a really one of those clarifying visions, which is like, wow, you know, I'm going to get old. And there's a certain point when I get old that I'm like, you know, I don't care about this upgrade, or I don't care about this gizmo. And then I went, and the second thought was, well, if that's going to happen in the future, I can just make that happen now. Like, if I don't want to, and I don't have to, you know, things are different if you have a certain kind of jobs you have to do. I mean, we're all trapped in various ways. If I don't have to do it, I can just say I don't want to do that now. So I still have a dumb phone. You know, I don't do the internet in my pocket thing, and I don't think I will have to. I mean, I lose out on it in some way. So I'm very interested in my generation being at this hinge point. One foot in, one foot out. And that's kind of how I think about it. And I don't think I can narrate the experience of an 18-year-old. You know, when I've been in conferences and talked about this stuff, you know, I don't try to say, hey, man, you're not understanding. You know, I'm really uncomfortable with, like, you know, you're so stuck in it, you can't appreciate, like, you know, older forms or whatever. I think the generational thing is a real issue. Yeah?
So you made a comment earlier, so this is sort of related. You made a comment earlier about sort of feeling an obligation to be optimistic about technology. And you sort of attributed that to your job as a journalist. And you just mentioned as a technology journalist, which you didn't say before exactly. So that would be an especially acute
Yeah,
obligation.
And that was luckily the past, because I think it would be harder to do that now.
Okay, but I'm wondering if it isn't bigger than just. But my question is, isn't it really probably bigger than just the obligation as a journalist?
The optimism.
Yeah, the sense of feeling as if one should feel
that's a really
optimism
good question.
About technology mm-hmm. and its products.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean. The one way that I've shifted a little bit is that I no longer am particularly optimistic about technology, because it's such a big idea and there's so many things that are going under that category, and so much of it is not so hot, that I'm trying to like shift to like being optimistic about the ways people can keep doing things that I think are valuable in the midst of these technological experiences that are sort of post-human or not really quite on the human scale. Anymore, but it is definitely an interesting sense of an obligation, and even being somebody who's speaking and communicating in the public is a weird thing, because what I will say in private with my friends when we're talking about things and getting freaked out is often much more pessimistic than I'll represent with people. I'm in a situation like this, and people ask a question, well, what about this, da, 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 and I'll be like, well, you know, this, and da, 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 da. And I'm not really sure sometimes why that is. Maybe it's, there's something for me that seems wrong about articulating in the public space a kind of driven pessimism. And I think that has to do partly with keeping the space open for possibility. There's always extraordinary possibility. The potentials are always there. And having too fixed an idea of how things are, you know, really shuts that off. At the same time, I'm really concerned with how uncritically people, especially today, and especially young people, how uncritically people take on this sort of hidden frameworks, assumptions, narratives that are embedded in our technology. But I don't believe that some kind of critical distance or some kind of language about distrust or suspicion is really necessarily going to do very much. So I'm quite confused about this issue at this point, more so than I used to be.
Do you think that's it's an interesting question to me, because do you think that this problem that you're articulating is unique to this current age, or could you go back to earlier epochs of technological development, like telephones, radios, television, and really,
or even printing,
and find a similar kind of shift and sort of implied narrative that's shifting the way that people interact. And to me, like, the deeper questions that you're pointing to about how do you even peel back the fact that there's the possibility that a narrative is actually operating and you're not aware of it.
Right.
That's to me where spiritual practice actually is an available possibility.
But yeah.
And yet, I don't see that being any different. The narratives are different now, but I don't think that's changed over time.
That's a great way. That's a really wonderful point, because that reminded me of another reason that I keep the pessimism at bay, because the pessimistic story, it's the same story. You've heard this a million times, and you just go back, and just being a student of the history of technology, it's like you can see it. And even for technologies that I think are super nifty, recorded music. Well, that's pretty kind of cool. Now it screwed around with some stuff. It changed the way we deal with music in our everyday lives in some ways that are really a bummer. Like in the 19th century, lots of people kind of played an instrument, and you were bored at night, and you'd sit around and sing songs, play instruments. That's pretty nifty. And then later on, you get this thing on, and then people listen to their different styles, and then it becomes more and more individual, so everybody has their own little thing, and we're all in our own private Idahos. And so, there's something really destructive about that process, but obviously it was also incredibly creative and rich. I mean, the robots in the future, if they have any interest in the history of human culture, will be totally psyched that there's a century's worth of extraordinary music that's recorded. I don't have greatest hopes about the future of recorded music. I think music's more interesting in other ways than in strict recording at this point. But the last 100 years were pretty nifty. So I do think that's the very form that the fear of the younger generation takes, and I think my concerns with technology are less about how it's impacting people, psychology. I have my concerns. I need to voice them, but I also realize that there are a lot of things that I'm just not perceiving, that I can't tell what it really means for people who are, invested and immersed in these things. But I am kind of, it's more the way that technology fits into some of these issues around surveillance and control, and what does it mean to be free, and where do you think, and some bigger kind of cosmic level of questions. But again, there, the spiritual practices are totally key, and also being familiar with the spiritual imagination. One part of technosis that I wrote about, and I wrote the book in the late 90s, and it actually holds up pretty well, which is sort of surprising given how technology changes. And one of the reasons was because I was even a little pessimistic then. And one of the chapters talks about precisely the idea of one globe, of the global mind, of the global consciousness, which on the one hand is an idea that's really popular with this great story history within modern spirituality, the idea of global consciousness, of the Gaian mind, as it gets phrased later, but you can trace it back all the way through the 20th century, that somehow what we're coming to is a place where we're all able to recognize a sort of commonality, a oneness, and that maybe this even is being reflected in the technology of the day. This is definitely what Teilhard de Chardin thought, for example, that this kind of sphere of thought that girded the globe of human thought and human consciousness was partly intensified and made real through our technologies. So on the one hand, we have the sense that technology is bringing us together, it's weaving us together, the global mind, the global village, in Marshall McLuhan's line. But of course, precisely that same structure, the global consciousness, the global mind, is terrifying from a paranoid point of view. It's awful to be in a global village. Villages are very paranoid places. Everybody knows what everybody else is doing. And that's where envy and witchcraft, and I mean, there's reasons that that stuff is, the village is not a bucolic place. It's a place of other kinds of human relationships. And now we're in this thing where we have real fears about, you know, the forces that are guiding and shaping global consciousness. And so what I talk about in that one chapter is just the way that the same condition of being woven together through technology, through media, through our minds, through our shared experience, through the resonance of our hearts and minds, can be seen as once an opportunity for a kind of spiritual transformation, and at the same time, the Antichrist system, the structure of Babylon, and that these are both images in the spiritual imagination, in the history of religious mythology, in the esoteric mind. These, both of these possibilities are there, the demonic and the utopian. And we experience those, work through those, have glimpses of them, both of them, as we try to navigate our very real historical moment, you know, as we even attempt to understand it without that mythology projected upon it, although I think it's very difficult to do, and that's what you see in popular media. That's what you see in the way that people respond to it. So you see in conspiracy theories, people who are caught up in this mixture of an understanding rooted in a very grounded way of what's going on, as well as these dreams and visions that are kind of leaking up from the unconscious. So it's another way in which spiritual practice and also a familiarity with the visionary imagination is very helpful in order to navigate the kinds of situations and conditions that we're in. So I've been, it's quarter till. You wanted one more question here? You get tuckered
questions.
Out. One question.
Could you define spiritual? You know, as how you spiritual, what do you mean?
Okay. It's a vague term. Totally. It's tough. It's, you know, I gotta admit, I've been writing about this stuff for 25 years. I still hate the term. There's nothing I can replace it with, because it's one way of answering your question is that, and this is an interesting fact, it has to do with generations as well, is that an increasingly large percentage of the population describes themselves when asked to define their religion as spiritual but not religious. And it's like an actual kind of category, and it's enormously growing in the young, like quite significantly. So we're going to see some very interesting changes in one generation based on how people think about it. So in answer to your question, it's like that stuff that doesn't quite fit in religion with a capital R, but is definitely not secular. And so it's in many ways, it's modern people and modern groups, meaning the last couple hundred years, who are, you know, in a world of technology and capitalism and all our world, attempting to plug into, extract, replace what religion has traditionally provided in a way that's not strictly religious. But of course, then you say, well, what's religion? Then that's another question. But that's sort of the way that I try to figure that, because it's a tough term.
I had an answer for you, your deliverance tip, about I'm rereading Camus, you know?
Uh-huh.
That's specificity. And I'll refresh it. Sisyphus is an ancient Greek personage who was forced to roll a rock up the hill for his entire life. And when he got to the top of the rock before he was on the other side of the hill, and he had to go back on the other side. The gods made him do this, you know. He did something wrong or something. And so you would think that would be a punishment. But Camus was saying that it's really a relief, because they've cut all the soap ties, all the soap chains. You know?
Right.
He has no hope whatsoever. This is his whole life.
Or I think, as and it's, there's also one little twist on that. It's not just that by losing hope that you're actually able to be free, which is an important idea in Buddhism as well. Getting beyond hopes and fears is, I think, a real key opportunity for our moment. But it's also, there's a certain injunction that Camus has, which is that we must imagine Sisyphus happy, which it's partly our imagination of. happiness in this very difficult situation. Yeah, that's partly what he's calling about. Yeah. Yeah. So I think it's a pretty good note to end on.
That is a very good note.
Thank you very
much.